today on Against the Grain. What did anarchism and Marxism look like in the 19th century? Were Marxists and anarchists always at loggerheads? And how did the Russian Revolution affect the dynamics and development of these two great idea systems? I'm CS. Anthony D'Agostino weighs in on these questions and argues that the Russian Revolution would not have occurred in the absence of World War I. Coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Marxism and anarchism. These two systems of thought are often portrayed as antagonistic and incompatible. The expulsion of the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin from the International Working Men's Association by Karl Marx and his followers in 1872 is often cited as proof of the irreconcilable differences between anarchist and Marxist thought. But according to Anthony D'Agostino, Marxists and anarchists came together, or at least took similar positions, on a number of important issues. D'Agostino also has a lot to say about the Russian Revolution and about the impact of Bolshevik actions and pronouncements on anarchists. Anthony D'Agostino is professor of history at San Francisco State University. His books include Marxism and the Russian Anarchists, The Russian Revolution, 1917 to 1945, and The Rise of Global Powers, International Politics in the Era of the World Wars. To the forthcoming Palgrave Handbook of Anarchism, Anthony D'Agostino has contributed a chapter on anarchism and Marxism and the Russian Revolution. In that chapter, he writes that in the period between 1815 and 1848, Marxism and anarchism grew up under similar influences. When Tony joined me recently in studio, I asked him what were those influences.
They both grew up basically in Paris, in student circles. This is a very heady bohemian atmosphere in which there's a lot of talk about replicating the French Revolution. So the French Revolution has pretty much ended by 1815, and it's been defeated. But everyone thinks at the time that there's going to be some kind of a rebirth of the French Revolution. And sure enough, that happened. In 1848, you get essentially the French Revolution occurring in a whole string of European countries. And it's a clash of the same forces that clashed in the 1790s. So all of the students in Paris and all the radicals are all talking about the same thing. Friedrich Engels, in his Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, gave a little rubric for understanding the synthesis of all the ideas that were being kicked around in the 1820s and 30s that went into Marxism. And he says that Marxism was a kind of a synthesis of French socialism, British political economy, and German philosophy.
And when you say British political economy, what ideas were they drawing from?
All the ideas from Adam Smith to David Ricardo, and these are all the notions we associate with the birth of economics as such. The heart of the matter, though, for most of these exiles was the notion of the labor theory of value, because it locates the source of profit-seeking in the value that is produced by the worker. So that's a very interesting concept for all of them. And some of their teachers had even been interested in that idea and its various implications. I mean, and these are implications that British political economy didn't particularly pursue, but they involve a certain claim on the product on the part of the worker. So they involve a radical notion. And British political economy also more or less prepares the ground for a theory of class struggle.
And German philosophy as an influence for, let's say, Marx and Engels, are we talking about Hegelian philosophy?
Yes, we are. The influence of German philosophy that Engels is talking about, there is more or less the whole package of German philosophy from Kant to Hegel. This is a whole series of propositions that have been put together, more or less summed up in the philosophy of Hegel. So most of the students, I think the people who are going to create anarchism, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, Mikhail Bakunin, and others, are pretty much subject to the same influences in this regard as Marx and Engels were. And In German philosophy, they're interested in the idea of the dialectic, the notion of historicism, the notion of history being as a being a determinant, which is going to make all the difference with regard to programs for the improvement of society. And Marx is going to end up pretty much with the idea that socialism is not a not an alternative to the existing society. It is the natural result of the existing society. So it's an entirely different attitude toward history that comes forward, and it comes out of German philosophy. So if you took that rubric that Engels uses there to describe the Marxist synthesis, the Marxian synthesis, some say, if you took that rubric, you could probably say the same thing for anarchism, that Proudhon and Bakunin, they're pretty much subject to the same kind of influences.
Mikhail Bakunin spent 11 years, beginning in 1849, in Russian prison and then exile. And you write that when Bakunin escaped from exile in 1861, the causes of 1848, and again, this 1848, the great year of revolution throughout Europe, the causes of 1848 were still alive for him until he became disillusioned. How did his disillusionment arise?
The disillusionment is with his previous thoughts, which revolve for the most part around Pan-Slavism. In 1848, he attended a Slav Congress, and they proclaimed that all the Slavs ought to unite in a large federation. And of course, that would have meant the overthrow of the Habsburg Empire and perhaps the overthrow of the Prussian and Russian empires, too. All the Slavs in Europe that were groaning under the yoke of these absolute monarchies in East Europe would presumably come together in some kind of federation. That's Bakunin's basic revolutionary idea in 1848. And when he was in prison and exile, he continued to argue in that way, and he tried to spin it in such a way as to interest the Tsar and also his other captives in Russia, try to interest them in that idea and the possibility of maybe a radical liberal monarchy, perhaps giving a little bit of a push to those notions. So those are the ideas that Bakunin brought back into Europe with him after coming virtually around the world from Yokohama to San Francisco to New York to London. And when he showed up in Herzen's apartment and he wanted to know where the revolution was going, he was thinking in terms of the old ideas of 1848. Things didn't go quite that way in the 1860s. Everything concentrated on a workers' movement rather than on a general rising of the peoples. There wasn't going to be another 1848, a springtime of all of the European peoples rising up. But what there was going to be was a workers' movement based on trade unions, and Bakunin was going to have to, you know, make his peace with that. And there he came up against Marx. And by 1864 or so, Bakunin started to give up the idea of Pan-Slavism, all his older notions, and started to think that perhaps this workers' movement, especially on an international scale, that this workers' movement might really be the thing to promote the revolution in the future, and perhaps that might be the thing for him. And that's when he became an anarchist, when he started to preach anarchism.
So anarchists thought class struggle was fundamental. Anarchists made room for class analysis?
Exactly. I mean, there's Engels' notion about political economy as the font for Marxism in the 1830s and 40s. And I would say it's the same thing for anarchism. Bakunin essentially accepts Marx's political economy, the notions of class struggle, the conception of the commodity, the labor theory of value, things associated with Marx's critique of political economy, as he called it. And he differs with Marx about the metaphysics of German philosophy, the hangover of German philosophy, and how Marx has turned into a logic chopper. As a German and a Jew, he is wed to these notions of authority and logic and all of the rest of that, which are essentially tyrannical notions. And eventually they'll have to be some kind of a break with that.
Remind us of the view or the attitude of anarchists toward the state, and what happened to Bakunin's view of the state as a result of the disillusionment we've been talking about?
Well, he started to make fundamental investigations into his thinking about the state and started to do some reading that he hadn't done before. And he came to the conclusion that Machiavelli had pretty much understood the state perfectly, understood all the essential logic of the state. And Machiavelli's arguments about the state do not have the class struggle at their heart. This is a kind of, in a way, a fundamental break. Although I stress, by the way, that this intellectual history is fascinating stuff, but the most interesting thing about anarchists and Marxists is how they related to the history of their times, because they were all revolutionaries and looking for ways to relate to that. But on this point, he came to the conclusion, Bakunin did, that classes arise in the state. That is to say, that state power is primary. You have to think about the state as the fundamental engine of oppression. And it's curious that if you look into Machiavelli's works, there are places where Machiavelli sounds almost like Bakunin, of all things. I mean, there's a place in his History of Florence where he's talking about the Ciampi revolts in the 14th century. And he's got this agitator who is addressing a crowd and who is saying that, oh, the ruling class only rules by force and by fraud, and we have to be faithless and bold, and we have to, you know. And he is essentially talking like a Machiavellian, that, you know, the end justifies the means, et cetera, et cetera. But it's an agitator who's addressing the workers. Well, Machiavelli was having fun with that and was imagining how a if he, Machiavelli, had been this agitator, how he would have addressed the masses. But this is Bakunin's style of revolution exactly. It is not a question of determining the exact state of the class forces, the exact state of the production regime, or things of that sort. It is that everybody can become a revolutionary, that everybody is oppressed, and that real revolutionaries can appeal to everybody on the basis of the fundamental fraud of the state, which is based essentially on force.
Anthony D'Agostino is his name. He's professor of history at San Francisco State University, and his books include The Rise of Global Powers, International Politics in the Era of the World Wars, and The Russian Revolution, 1917 to 1945. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In 1871, workers and their allies seized control of Paris, and declaring themselves autonomous from the state, they basically governed Paris for 2 months in the year 1871. How did Marxists and anarchists view the Paris Commune? And maybe if you want to share some other details, there are many more details to share about the Commune, please do so.
Well, the Commune comes at the end of the career of Napoleon III. So perhaps before I speak to the question of the Paris Commune in the thought of the Marxists and anarchists, I can address this problem of the regime that ended with the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71. The regime of Napoleon III, Louis Napoleon, the nephew of the first Napoleon. There's a thought about 1848 and all those revolutions that they all failed completely. In fact, A.J.P. Taylor, a famous European historian, once put it this way. He said that 1848 was a turning point that failed to turn. And that's pretty much the way it was taught to me. But I've come to the conclusion that this is not really right, that in 1848, all the attempts at revolution failed, but one did not. The French brought back Bonapartism. They eventually brought back Louis Napoleon and made him into the emperor and, recreated the Second Empire, which exists right up until the time of the war in 1870-71. The thing then is, was that a victory for revolution? Marx's attitude toward Napoleon III was that Napoleon III was completely reactionary and that there was nothing revolutionary about him at all. And I think for that reason, Marx and Engels did not support the wars that the Italians waged, the Risorgimento to create Italy. They didn't support that. They saw that as a threat to Germany. Now, Germany is not a very progressive country, according to this way of looking at things. And Austria similarly. In fact, you could make the argument that Austria is probably the most reactionary regime in Europe. Gladstone, the British politician, once said, I defy someone to look at a map and point to a place and say, there, Austria did good. There was a general feeling that Austria is very reactionary. So Marx and Engels are defending Austria. They're defending Prussia against the threat of Italian unity. Italian unity is going to destroy Austrian power in the Italies. Marx and Engels, for the most part, are looking at it from the standpoint of the interests of Germany and Austria here. And they see Napoleon III, who's really trying to bring Italy into existence by support for the Risorgimento. They see him as the enemy. They see him as the reactionary force there.
Yeah, in fact, you write that, and you emphasize in your writings, that Marx was a kind of German nationalist.
Well, he drew the conclusion. Well, he started out as a German nationalist, of course, in 1848. That would have been perfectly all right. To create a new Germany would have been a very, very progressive thing, Marx thought, in 1848, because it would have meant the first thing a new Germany would do would be to attack Russia, you know, have a war against Russia, and in the course of that war to free Poland from Russia. So that would be a very, very healthy, revolutionary, wholesome thing to do. And it is, you know, these are the things that Napoleon was thinking about as well. So that's Marx in 1848. Sometime in the 1860s or so, maybe a little bit after that, Marx came to the conclusion that the leading countries were not maybe France or Britain, but maybe the leading the country of the future was going to be Germany. Certainly in industrial terms, looking at it as a Marxist, in industrial terms, it looks as if Germany is perhaps more dynamic. And when Germany emerges at the end of these wars of German national liberation in the 1860s as a unified state, it looks as if that Germany is going to really be the European state of the future, which means perhaps the world state of the future. And it also seems to mean for Marx and Engels, and they indicate this fairly clearly in their correspondence, that this new state is going to also signify the ascendancy of the German worker. In other words, the victory of the German state over the French state signifies the ascendancy of the German worker. And also, Marx says to Engels, the ascendancy of our doctrine, Marxism, over Proudhonism. And so from this point on, Marx and Engels are going to think pretty much, I think, entirely in terms of this ascendancy of the German state. Now, not to suggest when we talk about them as nationalists, and perhaps that isn't the right way to talk about them, not to suggest that they have given up on their old ideas about revolution. Every one of them, all anarchists, Marxists, all of them, would have loved to see a revolution in any state and would have been most enthusiastic about that, certainly would not have supported the suppression of any revolution in any state. But the world they're dealing with is not giving them the revolution that they want. And they have to look at the world as it is actually shaping up. And this is what Marxism is all about. And it seems to suggest that Germany is the state of the future. So this continues with Engels after Marx's death. And you can see in his discussions with August Bebel, head of the German Social Democratic Party, which was a Marxist party, they're having a discussion about the threat of Russia to Germany and how Germany, and this is in the 1890s they're talking this way, they say if there's ever a war between Russia and Germany, Germany would be justified in doing absolutely anything in order to fight off these Russians.
I took you away from the Paris Commune. So again, Napoleon III, the nephew of Napoleon I, he was the Emperor of France from 1852 to 1870. The Paris Commune is in 1871. So tell us a little bit about that event and, again, the attitude that Marxists and anarchists had toward that.
So when the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71 ended with the Paris Commune, it started out as a great national rising of resistance to the foreign invaders. But it turned into a revolutionary movement throughout all of Paris. And the most revolutionary people were part of this commune leadership. Marx and Bakunin both had to make a decision how they felt about it. Bakunin was not in doubt. The idea of smashing the state completely as the commune had done, that was no problem for Bakunin. And so you might say the Paris Commune, I think most revolutionaries in Europe would have got the general impression that the Paris Commune was more in tune with the thinking of Bakunin and anarchism than it was with Marx and Marxism, which most of these revolutionaries would probably have associated with peaceful, legal trade union development, urging the trade unions to form themselves into a labor party, to segregate themselves politically from the bourgeoisie, as Plahanov, the Russian Marxist, later put it, to do all of these things rather than to make immediate insurrections and immediate revolution. That would be the old stuff of 1848. I think this would have been the impression of most of the revolutionaries around Europe, but it turned out not to be right. Marx was equally enthusiastic about the Paris Commune. He wrote an essay, The Civil War in France, in which he gave the Paris Commune his full endorsement and even went so far as to suggest that it was a hint of the dictatorship of the proletariat. As the workers who are taking power and are smashing the state, so to speak, and are commanding the direction of society on their own for the first time. And later on, after Marx was gone, Engels gave a formula just like that. And he suggested that it had really been an example, a very powerful example of the dictatorship of the proletariat, showed it was possible.
Would you say, though, that in the 19th century, Marx and his followers generally advocated this notion, as you said, of trade unions taking political power, forming political parties, using parliament as a way to advance their agenda? This is what was called social democracy, right? Mainstream social democracy in Europe.
Exactly so. Every European would have considered that Marxism meant this peaceful, legal, parliamentary path to a socialist future sometime in the distant future. They would not have taken into consideration this or that major cataclysm. Nobody planned on a world war, of course, to alter that presumed path for the development of the socialist and proletarian movement. So Marxism, you could say, takes a detour in that sense with the Russian Revolution. But Lenin had to contend with this problem. In 1917, he wrote The State and Revolution. And The State and Revolution gives a theoretical justification for the workers taking power in Russia. Russia, not the most advanced country industrially in Europe, although quite advanced, but not the place where you would have expected a proletarian revolution. But he's got to figure that out. And he goes back and he says, look what Marx wrote about the Paris Commune. So in a way, Lenin, in making this argument, is more or less reinstating an element in Marxism, which is not the peaceful, legal, parliamentary path of the social democracy. Another element, you can find it back in 1848, in fact, if you really look, the address of the Central Authority to the Communist League of 1850. Marx talks a lot like a Bolshevik. He talks about how the workers have to seize this and seize that. And so the Russian Bolsheviks were very interested in this idea of a real Marx that had been somehow clouded over and perhaps obscured by the social democratic evolution. So it gave them a way to criticize the social democracy. They had a quarrel in 1917. They had a quarrel with the social democracy that was a little bit more immediate. The social democracy, all these social democrats, had supported the war effort. So they're all leading their troops off to war. That's the real reason for the break of the Bolsheviks with the European social democracy, to whom they had been slavish adherents up until that time.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Anthony D'Agostino joins me. He is a diplomatic historian and a professor of history based at San Francisco State University. And much of what we were talking about today comes from an article on anarchism and Marxism and the Russian Revolution, an article that my guest is contributing to the Palgrave Handbook on Anarchism to be published later this year. So if social democrats in Europe supported the war effort, and we have Kropotkin, who takes over intellectual leadership of the anarchist movement after Bakunin dies in 1876, you know, it's hard to think of Kropotkin actually siding with the social democrats on a number of matters, including this one. What position did Kropotkin take on World War I and whether people should go and fight in it?
Kropotkin took the view that the most reactionary force, this would be the exact opposite of the attitude of Marx and Engels that I was describing previously, that the most reactionary force in Europe is the German monarchy, and the Social Democrats are practically the same thing as the left wing of the German monarchy, that they are playing ball entirely with German imperialism, and that in many ways they're just about as bad as German imperialism. They have all the same statism and all the same prejudices that Bismarck and his successors had as leaders of the German Empire. So there's a real, very powerful critique of the social democracy being made by Kropotkin and his adherents. There's even a man named Varlam Cherkezov, who wrote some pamphlets to the effect that Marx and Engels plagiarized the Communist Manifesto. So they really went overboard in their attack on Marxism and made it out to be very, very reactionary and very much in league with German imperialism. Even without that, these anarchists certainly, in an all-out war, if they had to make the decision, would have been on the side of the land of the French Revolution. Would have been on the side of the French. They would not have wanted a German absolute monarchy to defeat the French Revolution. So they took the view that France has to be defended at all costs. France is in an alliance with Russia. The Russian soldiers, if they want to defend the foyer of freedom and free thought, France, if they wanted to defend France, they had to report to the colors in the Russian army and take on France's enemy. So this is the view that Kropotkin took, and it's also just about exactly the view that Georgi Plekhanov took as the leading light, the patron saint of Russian Marxism. So both social democrats and anarchists, that is to say, both Plekhanov and Kropotkin take the view that Russia has to be defended against German militarism.
What did anarchists like Enrico Malatesta think of Kropotkin's support of the war?
Malatesta, like Lenin, felt that this endorsement of the world war was a betrayal of the principles of his movement. So just as Lenin revolted against the social democracy in general because of its support for the war, so did Malatesta, Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, the younger generation of anarchists. They revolted against the war and made the argument in a manifesto that they issued in 1915 that the world war ought to be turned into a civil war. It was an occasion for a revolution to overthrow every state in Europe. This is almost exactly the same position that Lenin takes on the left of the Zimmerwald movement in 1915. So there is a certain, how to put it, there's a rendezvous between anarchism and Marxism, that is to say their extreme left elements, in this anti-war position. So the war, to me, the war is the thing in that case.
Anthony D'Agostino, historian at San Francisco State University, will take a short break and speak more with him about anarchism and Marxism and the Russian Revolution. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Anthony D'Agostino's books include Marxism and the Russian Anarchists, Soviet Succession Struggles, and The Rise of Global Powers, International Politics in the Era of the World Wars. He joins me to talk about, well, a number of thoughts that he's had over the years, some of which have been put by Anthony into an article that he has written for the Palgrave Handbook on Anarchism to be published later this year. So by saying that World War One was kind of the thing, I mean, yeah, a lot of people would say, well, you know, we had World War One. It lasted from 1914 to 1918. We had the Russian Revolution, actually the Russian Revolutions of 1917. And speak about those two things, those two events, cataclysms, in isolation. So would the Russian Revolution have occurred, in your opinion, if World War One had not? And of course, you know, we have to think about what World War One did to people in Russia, to peasants and to workers.
Russian historians have been kicking this around for a while, and it kind of varies. Each generation of Russian historians has a different view of the matter. It used to be, when I was a student, it was argued that the war really wrecked everything, that Tsarist Russia was solving its problems. If only the war hadn't intervened, everything would have gone better. They don't never put it more strongly than that. That was a view of my generation when I was a student. And then as I got into teaching, most of the Russian historians started to argue a different line. And by the 1980s, they had made the argument that the Russian Revolution really was only the culmination of a series of absolutely inexorable tendencies in the Tsarist Empire. Workers were rising, the peasants were restive. These problems could not have been contained, that the revolution would have happened, war or no war. So that was a view. Just about all my contemporaries took that view. But I have never bought that idea somehow. I have the view that there would have been tremendous upheaval in Russia, and who knows, perhaps some authoritarian regime of the worst sort employed to contain them. But that the regime could never have been overthrown, could not possibly have been overthrown, had it not been for the war. So for me, in my interpretation of the thing, the war is everything. And I look at this in terms of just the mechanics of revolution. Revolution happens in the armed forces. Only under the conditions of the war do you see the workers drafted, trained, organized, and armed, taken out of their communities and thrown in together, and then into a failing effort at the front in which the losses are on such a scale that their lives are practically forfeit if they continue with this struggle, you know, practically forced into the idea of mutiny, which was happening on all the fronts at the end of World War One. Only under these circumstances could the Tsarist regime have been driven under. Then you say, how could the Bolsheviks, the most radical party in Europe, the most radical part of the social democracy, you could even say, how could they get power? How were the workers radicalized to such a degree during 1917? And I would say, on account of the war, because of the pressure of the war and the opportunities presented by the war. As they throw up a workers' council in the capital city and replicated by workers' councils in most of the major towns in Russia, these workers' councils are capable of making an appeal to the garrisons, to the armed forces. And in that way, they start to take on semi-governmental pretensions. They start to be, in effect, a revolution themselves. What the Russians like to call dual power, that it's a question of whether the government can get its orders obeyed by the garrison, or whether the garrison is going to look to the Soviet for a source of authority. That is, and whether it might come to a certain point where the Soviet might tell the soldiers to overthrow the existing government and to make peace, of course. And the existing government, no longer just protecting stability, but put in a position where it has to make the workers fight.
Would Lenin and the Bolsheviks have had the same appeal among the masses if Lenin had not advocated for Russia's withdrawal or removal from World War One?
I'm not sure how every Russian historian would answer that question, but I really have no doubt that the war issue is the one that brought the Bolsheviks to power. Is that the answer to the question you're posing?
Yeah. I mean, basically, yeah. So many people wanted to get out of the war, of World War One, that they... Yeah. They look to the Bolsheviks.
Yeah, this is the main reason for the rapid rally of all the workers in Russia and the peasants, too, because the peasant Soviets are also rallying to the Bolsheviks by the time the Bolsheviks took power in October 1917.
What did anarchists think of the Soviets or the workers' councils and their revolutionary potential. I guess not revolutionary in the sense of effecting revolution after the Bolsheviks took over, but of kind of moving the revolution in a continually progressive and radical direction.
The anarchists take the view that, on the whole, take the view that the Soviet represents the real repository of workers' self-activity, so to speak. Two instruments, the factory committees. These are grassroots organizations, not trade unions exactly, but grassroots organizations at the point of production. These came up very strongly and fought for an eight-hour day during 1917 and had a big influence, had some conferences. And Bolsheviks and anarchists, you know, they made common cause in these things against Mensheviks, interestingly. And both of those are going to be opposed on the question of the war as well. These factory committees and the Soviets, there was an anarchist by the name of Maximov, G.P. Maximov, who made the argument that this is the new anarchism. The old anarchism is based on trade unions, anarcho-syndicalism. He said the new anarchism is based on these factory committees, not trade unions. And trade unions, of course, lead naturally to parliaments. We're not for parliaments either. The factory committee leads naturally to the Soviet. The factory committee and the Soviet, those are the axis around which the real workers' revolution will revolve in the future. So the anarchists have more or less the same views as the Bolsheviks. And they even had a slogan to describe this. They said, march separately, strike together. So here, anarchism and Marxism essentially making the same arguments. So when you see Lenin writing about this in State and Revolution, he is opening the door to a what you might call a misinterpretation of Bolshevism as a kind of anarchism. Now, you could say this is the most cynical thing in the world, but strictly speaking, in terms of all the things that the Bolsheviks actually did in fact in 1917, as opposed to the things that anarchists did in fact, they were marching together. They did represent essentially the same thing as against, say, Mensheviks and those socialist revolutionaries, that's the Peasant Party, who still supported the war effort. So there is a kind of conjunction between anarchism and Marxism. And we've seen this before. We've seen it in the Paris Commune, haven't we? We've seen it in at various times when Marxists endorse the idea of workers' control, for example. This kind of conjunction of Marxism and anarchism at their extreme lefts, of course.
If anarchists and Marxists made common cause to some extent, even in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, then when did the rift, when did the break happen? When did the Bolsheviks move in the other direction and the anarchists feel betrayed and abandoned?
To read anarchist material in the 1920s, you would think that they never really got along with the Bolsheviks. There was always this great struggle going on between them, but the revolution was going on. So they didn't lay great emphasis to the things that we've been talking about, this community of effort between anarchism and Marxism. And so the question then emerges, you know, when did this actually come, the actual break between them? I don't know. You could place it in a number of different ways. One view is that there was a raid on one of the squatters' setups in the dacha of P.N. Durnovo, a defense minister in the Tsarist regime, who had a big, not a dacha, but a big villa right in the middle of a Moscow neighborhood where the anarchists were squatting. They were evicted in the spring of 1918. But I don't think that's right. That's not the real division. You see a lot of anarchist denunciations of the high-handed Bolsheviks and blah, blah, blah. They represent the state and et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a mistake to make too much of that because the anarchists, for the most part, throughout the whole period of the Civil War, and this extends from 1917 to 1921, are definitely on the side of the Bolsheviks. And I don't just mean speaking on their behalf. I mean arms in hand. Working with them, fighting with them against the whites. And this includes Nestor Makhno, the great anarchist revolutionary in the Ukraine. He's fighting all of the occupiers of the Ukraine, that is Germany, Austria. And then after the Central Powers are defeated at the end of 1918, he's taking on all other white forces. And finally, he's fighting the major forces of General Denikin in 1920. So it goes right up through the Civil War, this cooperation, this community, so to speak, between anarchism and Bolshevism. And then it ends, and it ends with the Kronstadt Revolt.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm joined in studio by Anthony D'Agostino. He is professor of history at San Francisco State University. And by the whites in the Soviet Union, of course, we're talking about, and in Russia, we're talking about the broad constellation of forces that were opposed to the Bolsheviks. So the Kronstadt Rebellion or Revolt, this, of course, was a naval fortress on an island in the Gulf of Finland. And we have sailors and soldiers and workers and others rising up against the Bolsheviks in March of 1921. Tell us more about that revolt and how the anarchists viewed the crushing of the revolt by the Red Army.
Well, for the anarchists, this is the last straw. In the literature of anarchism after the Russian Revolution, you'll see it commonly referred to as the moment when anarchism and Bolshevism definitely parted ways and, you know, there's no turning back and et cetera. With a few exceptions. for example, Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, they both wrote books about Russia after they left Russia in the 20s. Emma wrote My Disillusionment in Russia and My Further Disillusionment in Russia as a sequel. And they tried to make it out that they had had all sorts of objections to the Bolsheviks through the Civil War. And this is not right. They were not representing that correctly. I was under the impression of their works when I got plunged into the archive, their archive with all their correspondence and a lot of other anarchist correspondence at the International Institute for Social History in Amsterdam. And I read all this correspondence, and that's not what they're saying in those days. During the Civil War, they're not complaining about the Bolsheviks. Quite the reverse. They're saying the Bolsheviks represent the only hope for mankind. The worst thing in the world is this Allied intervention. The British and the French and as many as 14 nations, all told, intervening on Russian soil. There would not be a civil war in Russia without this intervention. They argue. The Bolsheviks have to be supported, et cetera, et cetera. So that continues right up to Kronstadt. And then, of course, it breaks at Kronstadt. Because in Kronstadt, you have some anarchist slogans put forward. Basically, these presumed anarchist slogans do not reflect an ideological turn against the Bolsheviks. They reflect a change in the agrarian policy, in my opinion. The Bolsheviks have been carrying out compulsory grain requisitions on the countryside from the beginnings of the Civil War. And now peace is breaking out at this moment. The Bolsheviks have completely won the day in 1919 and 1920. There's really not much to say for the whites after that. It's when this peace started to break out that peasants all over Russia got totally fed up with the wartime requisitions, and they interpreted it that way, that these requisitions that the Bolsheviks were making of their grain, that this was only going on because of the war. And as a matter of fact, there's a reflection of that that actually caused the Kronstadt Revolt, because it's a closing of the black market in Kronstadt that produced a general strike. The black market was just about the only thing that was producing food for the Petrograd workers. And Zinoviev and the leadership of the Bolshevik Party decided to crack down on the black market, and that produced a general strike. The sailors at Kronstadt came out in support for the general strike. The anarchists started to issue some slogans, among which was Soviets without communists. And so that's how that happened. That's the mechanism for that happening. That's the thing that explains that this Kronstadt Rebellion was answered by the Bolsheviks with the new economic policy that began in 1921 when the Bolsheviks opened up a free market for agricultural produce. So it's the revolt against the wartime conditions and the transition over to a new system, the uncertainty of the peasants whether they'd be under a military collectivization, basically, military discipline, or whether there'd be some new regime on the countryside. That, I think, is the underlying premise for the Kronstadt Revolt. But it is the occasion for the anarchists now to take the position of the peasantry and to say, and of the Kronstadt workers and the sailors, the vanguard of the revolution in 1917, and to say that the Bolsheviks represented tyranny over them. And so that does represent a final break with the Bolsheviks.
Let me ask you to say a little bit more about Nestor Makhno. So Russia hands Ukraine over to the Germans in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and this ends Russia's involvement in World War I. But to reach a separate peace with Germany and Austria, Russia hands certain lands over to those nations. So Nestor Makhno is not going to have any of that. He raises an army to try and defend much of Ukraine from German forces. And as you said, he defends Ukraine from other forces over time. So the Bolsheviks obviously were cheering this man on, right? They liked the fact that he was fighting off the Germans. So was Makhno tempted to cozy up to the Bolsheviks? And if he didn't, what kept him from doing that?
Well, he certainly would have been willing to play ball with the Bolsheviks. He made a trip to Moscow. He sat down with Lenin. They had friendly discussions, and Lenin told him that if only anarchists behave the way you behave, you know, we would have no difficulty cooperating with them on all things. And that, of course, is perfectly right. If the anarchists had made themselves part of the Bolshevik movement, a certain subordinate part of the Bolshevik movement, of course, they would have gone along splendidly, and Lenin would have loved that. And they took advantage of Makhno as much as they could, and they were pretty much fighting on the same side. Strictly speaking, the Bolsheviks might have let things sit that way in the 20s and left the Makhno question to go through a certain evolution, you know, this anarchist society, although one wonders if it isn't just an ordinary peasant society living in a collective way, in a very traditional Russian collective way, but let this anarchist society go through its normal evolution in the south of the Ukraine. I think they could have done this, but they took the initiative instead. Mainly Trotsky probably had something to do with this, of taking the decision that they had to make sure the army was loyal. That's to say that it was part of the Red Army and would obey the orders of the Red Army under all conditions. In other words, there was a certain suspicion about anarchism, whether they could trust anarchism. And so they tried to see if they could get Makhno to transfer his leadership to another front. That's the point at which Makhno would have had to leave his home turf in order to stay on good terms with the Bolsheviks. Of course, he refused that. That's insubordination. And so there's the end of the cooperation between the Bolsheviks and the anarchists. But maybe if they'd played that differently, they might have got along with Makhno for another 10 years. Who knows?
That's Anthony D'Agostino. He is a professor of history and a diplomatic historian at San Francisco State University. And this piece that you have contributed to the Palgrave Handbook on Anarchism, which will be published later this year, it addresses some of the ideas of a guy named Jan Vacław Machajski, and specifically of Marxism. Well, actually, he critiqued a lot of ideological strains, including anarchism. He ended up, as you write, being part of the Bolshevik apparatus in the Soviet Union. What was his critique, and a kind of a blistering critique against Marxism that had to do with intellectual workers and the intelligentsia?
Machajski was involved in Polish activity, underground Polish activity, and underground Russian activity around the turn of the century. And he wrote a huge work called The Intellectual Worker, Umstvini Robochi, it's called, published in 1905. Well, it isn't exactly huge, but when you get started reading it, you would think it's huge. It's an enormous thing. Intellectually, especially the second part, which is all economics and which is goes into the second volume of Capital. And all of this in order to make the argument that the workers could not trust the social democrats in Europe because socialism and especially Marxist socialism was not the doctrine of the emancipation of the workers, but the doctrine of the intelligentsia. So the intelligentsia, he said, was the rising class in society that the Marxists say it's only the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. But in between are these white-collar workers, professionals, civil servants, managers, superintendents of various sorts. All this middle level of society, the intelligentsia, And it had its own outlook on the whole question of capitalism, and it was an attitude of compromise toward a rational running of capitalism in such a way that the intellectual workers would be the leading beneficiary. And even if the most revolutionary doctrines of the Marxists were to become flesh in some country, especially in Russia, even if these Marxists were able to take power, that they would still institute a regime, even under the conditions of a dictatorship of the proletariat, that would be essentially the dictatorship of the intelligentsia over the proletariat. And the reason for this would be that wage work would continue to be the norm under the dictatorship of the proletariat, and that salaried work, which these intelligentsia would be engaged in, this would get a higher reward than wage work, and eventually they'd be the privileged order of the new society. I think Mihaisky was onto something in that socialism. I think on the whole, if you kind of look at it in general, it really is a regime in which the intelligentsia does get to run everything.
Right. I mean, state socialism means the creation of huge bureaucracies that plan the economy and run it.
Well, the people who don't like them call them bureaucracies, and the people who do like them call them administrations. And these latter say they're quite essential, and some would even make the argument they're essential to capitalism as well. Saint-Simon made this argument back in the 1830s, and indeed Bakunin's critique of Marx treats Marx as if Marx were the same thing as Saint-Simon. Saint-Simon said scientific intellect will run the society of the future, and the savants will be, in effect, its rulers, the rulers of a new order. I don't think that is such a wild thing to say about modern society, that you do need all of these professional, technical, and whatever people, and that society really can't get along without them. So in other words, I would put it the way Saint-Simon put it, but Mihaisky put it in a slightly different way. He said it was treason to the workers for this to be the case. And I guess I would say it was a much more normal thing. And Mihaisky said the only remedy for this would be the socialization of knowledge. Knowledge was a kind of capital that the workers could not emancipate themselves unless they seized hold of education. That was the thing the intelligentsia had that they didn't. And so this socialization of knowledge strikes me as a perfectly wholesome conception. And of course, it's all very Saint-Simonist rather than anarchist, but I think they are saying basically the same thing.
Anthony D'Agostino, he certainly participates in this socialization of knowledge. He teaches history at San Francisco State University. He's a diplomatic historian. You can look for the chapter he's contributing on anarchism and Marxism in the Russian Revolution to the forthcoming Palgrave Handbook on Anarchism. And his books include Marxism and the Russian Anarchists, The Russian Revolution, 1917 to 1945, and The Rise of Global Powers, International Politics in the Era of World Wars. Anthony, thanks so much for your work, and thanks so much for joining us today.
C.S., it's been a great pleasure.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.